This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the ball on the show.
Here's Danny and Gallant, and Jake Heaps came back with, well, a new bit of perspective. He returned yesterday and said that he had heard something. It's a name Seattle fans are going to be familiar with. It's a name fans, Seattle fans should be excited about, Jamal Adams. And Jake Heaps on Tom, Jake, and Stacey said that the Seahawks, well, they're hip deep in the pursuit of the all-pro safety from the Jets.
I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine who works in a front office on the other side of the country for an NFL team, and we were talking, and he actually said, so your Seahawks are really into Jamal Adams. And I was like, excuse? Like, what do you mean by that? Right? Yeah, like, what? Okay, I'm interested. Wait, I'm interested. and they're another team that's interested in Jamal Adams. And he said, yeah, the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing the Seahawks. Or the Seahawks are absolutely pursuing Jamal Adams in this situation.
Bump was excited. Michael Bump has said, give me somebody to believe in. Give me a star. And Jamal Adams fits that bill, right? He is a frontline player. He is a top 10 pick at a safety, which is... Look, that is unusual. When you have a safety chosen in the top 10, that's not something that happens every year. That's something that happens more like a few times a decade. And this is a guy who has been the bright spot on a Jets team that hasn't been very good. He wants to be paid. He's unhappy. He wants out. He's made that clear. Should Seattle be jumping at this opportunity?
They should definitely think about it, but I think the big problem is going to be the asking price for the Jets. And I would imagine that they're going to ask for a lot. They don't have to trade him right now, no matter what Adams is saying, because Adams is still under his rookie deal. So if Adams holds out, okay, he's not going to be any closer to free agency. He's also not going to get paid. The CBA works out in the Jets' favor from that standpoint. So they're probably going to have to pay at a premium for him. If they can get him for like one draft pick or something like that, if we're talking like a second or something along those lines, okay. But when I look at that, when I look at the fact that he is already asking for a new contract and he's not even really close to being there, when I'm looking at the idea that he probably wants to reset the market for safeties as well, when he's only got, what, two career interceptions? Got a lot of sacks this past season, I think, but this is a guy that I don't know is going to be worth the expensive cost for the Seahawks. Because I don't know that he's going to all of a sudden, Danny, turn the defense into a unit that's better in coverage or a unit that's better at getting after the passer. And those are the two big issues for the Seahawks. Jamal Adams is a thumper at the second level.
Well, let's hear from Jake and what he thinks Jamal Adams would bring to the defense.
I think that could be a really dynamic trade and a big boost for the Seahawks that could really make that defense and that defensive backfield back to that Legion of Boom, type of status again. Because Jamal Adams, as much as we reminisce about Cam Chancellor, Jamal Adams is a generational talent at that position and plays very similarly to Cam.
It's an intriguing sales pitch. And if you think that Jamal Adams is that player, there's absolutely the room to go and get him. I don't think he fits what Seattle needs right now like that. I think Seattle's, if they're going to spend big on a high-end player, I think it's a pass rusher. I honestly just, the difficulty in finding that, the fact that last year they let one walk in Frank Clark and we're not really any closer, they're kind of back in the same spot they were 12 months ago. I'd want a pass rusher. If you're going to pay through the nose for somebody, I want a pass rusher. But that idea of, hey, this is a generational talent. That's the reason that you'd pull the trigger on this and do it. Seattle is in a spot where they have a lot of spending flexibility going forward. They have a lot of potential stars. They don't have anybody that they know is a star outside of Bobby Wagner, right? Like, of all the different guys, Shaquille Griffin's a good player that you're hoping becomes a great corner, and he's shown great progress. Trey Flowers is somebody who was promising as a rookie. Not really sure if he's going to be a starter for you. Quentin Dunbar looks really promising. They have a lot of guys that they think could be good, but the one star they have is Bobby Wagner, and he's a guy that's at a point where you're hoping he continues to produce, not getting better. They need to find They need to find stars. And if you go out and trade for Jamal Adams, it's your decision. I mean, that he has to be a star. And not only that, not only does he have to be a star, but then you're going to have to be able to find guys to complement him in the draft. And I think to me that would be, acquiring Jamal Adams would be an admission that all of the time you spent looking for safeties these past 3 to 4 years, well, after all of that, you just threw up your hands and you said, okay, fine, we'll pay top price. Fine, we're going to stop trying to find guys in the draft. We're going to stop trying to find guys on the trade market. We're going to pay the premium price for the not an open box. This is, we're going to pay full freight to get ourselves a good defensive back in here.
I don't necessarily have a problem with that though, because I think you should be able and willing to admit that you've made mistakes in some of your evaluations. But the real question is about, do the Seahawks know the answer to what Marquise Blair is already? And if you're looking for stars to develop on the defense, you would think that a star, someone like Marquise Blair, if he's going to be a star, he would have been able to play as a rookie. Now, maybe there were some minor things, injuries and confusion that we're not 100% aware of, but I feel like if anyone has the answer to whether or not they are holding a star in their deck of cards right now, in their hand of cards, the Seahawks would know that with Marquise Blair. And I think the idea that they are making a phone call, at least per what Jake is hearing, I think that implies that they are not feeling great about Marquise Blair.
Well, no, he didn't play that much last year. Look, if he was awesome, you would have seen him out there more. And I'm not sure why Seattle didn't play as many of the young players on its defense last year. I'm not sure why Ugo Amadi took so long to get him back at nickel corner after he started out that year. I'm not sure why Cody Barton didn't get nearly as many opportunities. And Marquise Blair is one. When he played, he looked great. But the fact that the team was reluctant to trust him as a starting safety certainly speaks to the level of confidence they have in him. That question of how you go about getting a defense to get over, how do you push it over the top? Seattle has typically not been a team that pays the big sticker price. They did it with Percy Harvin, but most of their other acquisitions under Pete Carroll have been when they've traded for guys or made acquisitions for players already in the league, it's been someone who's no longer kind of at the peak of their earning power. That somebody else has paid for the depreciation. They've taken him. He's been off the lot already. When they traded for Jimmy Graham, like Jimmy Graham was a top-tier player, but Jimmy Graham had just signed a new contract. It was the Saints that ended up sort of eating salary cap money to get rid of him. When they traded for Quandre Diggs, Diggs was someone they gave up a draft pick for him, but the Lions had already paid a signing bonus to him to get rid of him, and he's on a relatively affordable. Seattle has generally, when they acquire guys that are already in the league, it's not sort of that new car smell that they have. Jamal Adams would definitely have the new car smell. Like, he's a guy would want the reason he's available is because he wants more than the Jets are willing to talk to him about right now. So you're going to have to pay, and I would say, the Jets probably want a first-round pick for him. They probably want a first-round pick for him. And then when you trade for him, you have to trade for him with the idea that, okay, and then we're going to pay him. And then we're going to make him one of the absolute highest-paid safeties in the league. And that's an awful lot. That's an awful lot because that guy has to work out. If you do that, that guy, you have margin. If Quandre Diggs doesn't work out, like, it doesn't cost you that much. If you trade and sign Jamal Adams, it absolutely has to work out. And Seattle has been pretty good about not leveraging themselves in those situations.
A long-term contract for Jamal Adams could cost you in a bunch of different ways. First off, from the standpoint of, okay, well, you might have less flexibility in the coming seasons because of the idea that the salary cap might shrink due to everything that's been going on with the pandemic. But also, if you're making that trade too, if you end up trading a first-round pick, here is what you are potentially punting on. And I know that the Seahawks sometimes trade out of the first round. They did not this year. You are punting on the possibility of drafting a tackle or an offensive lineman that actually has the potential to be one of those Pro Bowl to All-Pro kind of guys. Like, that's out the window. Generally, those guys are found in the first round. It's very rare that you find yourself with a tackle that's going to be something of consequence after round one, after round two. Second off, you're also doing the same thing with a pass rusher. And at the Seahawks this year, where they eventually basically said to them, to us, all right, we're hoping Collier works out. We're going to plug in Bruce Irvin. We're going to plug in Benson Mayoa. But we don't really know what's going on, and we're hoping Daryl Taylor, who we had a first-round grade on, is going to be able to be a guy that can be relied on as an actual consistent pass rusher in the future. But if that doesn't work out, okay, all of a sudden that first-round pick is gone. That hurts your ability to address both of those positions. And at some point, Danny, you have to say to yourself, we need to make this guy work. And that might be a crazy strategy, but you have to have some of these young players step up. You're not going to become 2013 and 2014 unless some of those guys develop, and you can't have them develop unless they play.
You still patient with them? And I think that's the question. You've got a lot of options or possibilities. You have a lot of lottery tickets. You don't have any sure things. Like, the closest thing to a sure thing you have among your young players is Jordan Brooks, right? A linebacker that you got in the first round that you feel like the closest thing of all your young players that you have, Daryl Taylor, Ugo Amadi, Cody Barton, Marquise Blair, like all of those guys are guys that you hope, and you haven't certainly sort of said, well, I don't think we'll be able to. But of all the different guys you have, it's a lot of hope. Do you feel like you need to add a sure thing? Re-signing Jadeveon Clowney would have been a sure thing. Adding Jamal Adams would be a sure thing. Are you happy with the lottery tickets you have, or do you want a sure thing?
I like what I saw from Blair last year, but it was in such small spots. I liked what I saw from Amadi last season, but it was legitimately a fumble return against the Panthers. He was so fast on that return. That's more, he's a returner than potentially a guy that can make an impact on a defense. To be perfectly honest, I don't feel comfortable with those lottery tickets. I would like a sure thing. I would like a sure thing now, and maybe I'm flip-flopping here and sounding like somebody that would like to trade for Jamal Adams, but I don't know that Jamal Adams is really a sure thing. I know he's been described as a really good safety, and I'm not going to act like I've watched a ton of his film or anything like that, but what I know the general scouting report on him is that he's more of a hitter than he's been like one of those guys that's going to make an impact on the deep end. And, you know, it was great to have Cam Chancellor in the middle of the past decade, but I don't know if those guys work anymore. I think that is a bit of a dinosaur position, and, you know, maybe that's an indictment on Marquise Blair, but I don't know that he's the sure thing.
Safety, I think safety, the price of safeties has come down, and John Clayton kind of bucked back. By the way, John Clayton going to be talking to Pete Carroll. That's going to be this morning at 11 a.m. I know Pete and Michael Gervais have been talking to another people. Yep, Pete Carroll going to be appearing with the professor this morning at 11 a.m. He pointed out, like, Eddie Jackson got a big contract, but it seems like the last couple safeties, that Earl Thomas didn't quite get what he wanted. Tyrann Mathieu didn't get as much as he wanted. So I'm not sure if the market for safeties is as lucrative as maybe and most concerning Jamal Adams might think it be. I think you might be paying through the nose for a position where the overall value of that position is going down. And I just think he's the wrong kind of safety for Seattle's system. Not that you can't use a big hitting guy, but man, like, Seattle's, I think what they miss is the center fielder. I think if you're going to pay a premium for a safety, give me a guy that's got that range, kind of like Earl Thomas did, or a little less. Like, give me someone whose skill set and biggest trait is the amount of ground he can cover on the back end. And I don't think that that's necessarily what Jamal Adams' strength is. It's Danny and Gallant. Now it's time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
Yes! Exceptional Friday, fellas. Cam Newton begins workouts with new teammate N'Keal Harry, but how excited do you think his teammates are just to have him on the roster?
I think they're pumped. I think Cam's teammates like him. Like, that's always been my impression. I've thought that Cam's teammates generally tend to like him. The only guy that I ever remember him complaining about was Josh Norman, which honestly, it seems like there's a fair number of people who don't like Josh Norman. Like, he seems like one of the more difficult, feisty personalities. I'll bet the Patriots players are pumped to have him.
I think Patriot players are pumped for what will likely be a breath of fresh air. I don't think that Belichick is going to necessarily stifle him like we have seen him potentially stifle free spirits in years past. I do wonder about the long-term shelf life of someone like Newton. But you're right. Newton is liked. And honestly, I highly recommend those who doubt Cam Newton, and maybe you see all the pouting and you see the guy that didn't die for the fumble in the Super Bowl and all that. Go back and watch that All or Nothing for the Panthers in 2018. You're going to come away with a different opinion of Cam Newton, because I know I did. I know that I had some doubts about like Cam Newton's maturity and all of that. That guy's tough. His teammates like him. And you know, Danny, even while he and Josh Norman may have had some disagreements, I think it was like playful disagreements, because there was a scene in that All or Nothing where it's like an hour-long phone call between Josh Norman, Greg Olsen, and Cam Newton where they're just busting each other's chops. It was really funny.
It was hilarious. I remember Norman hitting him in a training camp, and then like Newton had a couple of choice descriptions of him, which I found extremely funny. I thought they were hilarious.
Joe Burrow.
A urine.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, I was like, that's old school. That's an old school insult.
Oh man, you know what? I like English. You know, insults where they like call people like a daft cabbage, and I'm sorry that might be actually inappropriate over there, but as far as I know, it's really funny here. Joe Burrow, who's just in his rookie year with the Bengals, which hasn't really even started yet, he's partnered with the Athens County Food Pantry to create the Joe Burrow Hunger Relief Fund, and it will serve the region.
Are you rooting for Joe Burrow?
I'm not optimistic for him. I think that that's an impossible franchise. I think that's the hardest franchise to win with in the NFL. I think Marvin Lewis will look better and better the further we get from that era, because I think he did the impossible and win there. I am rooting for Joe Burrow. I'd like to see him be successful.
They are a forgotten, suffering fan base. And I empathize with those fan bases more than I empathize with someone like Cleveland or someone like Chicago. And it's because I used to cover one of those fan bases that's sort of forgotten as a suffering fan base, like Houston Oilers / Texans fans. It's been a pretty miserable history for them, including a team that actually skipped town. So I'm absolutely rooting for Joe Burrow in Cincinnati. I'd like to see the Bengals actually be good again.
Well, despite having 7 more years on their naming rights contract, FedEx says it will take its name off of the Washington NFL franchise stadium until the name is changed.
This is... We talked about this yesterday, that the money's finally come down. I guess part of the thing that FedEx said is that their proximity, like their logo being located next to the Washington Epithets logo, like actually tarnishes their business. Which I was like, wow, like this is the most corporate capitalist like feud I think I can remember seeing. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be. If Daniel Snyder won't change the nickname, I think they're going to make Daniel Snyder sell the team.
I wouldn't be surprised by that. I really do wonder logistically how quickly you can change a team nickname. And I know I brought that up yesterday. I suppose that Washington has no choice, and it's not like they have other things to really focus on right now, because attendance wasn't really much of an issue for them, given the way that things have gone for them over the last couple of years. But how do you roll out a new logo? How do you roll out new uniforms? Do you just go into the season with the same uniforms but no logo on the side of the helmet or something like that, looking like you're some sort of team from the 1950s or 40s? I think that's really the only route they can go.
Come on. It's America 2020. We can put football uniforms out tomorrow, can't we? And get some stickers out there.
Oregon does it every day.
The thing is, I think there are rules about uniform changes, and you can only do them once every I think 3 to 5 years. So if you're going to release a new uniform and it's not a good one, or it's an incomplete product and you're not satisfied with it, I think you're stuck with it. And that's why the Rams have been in this weird zone where they had to, until they changed to surprisingly worse uniforms than they already had. They had this like weird awkward phase where they were blending like 3 eras of their uniforms together and none of it matched, and it drove me crazy.
Well, I believe there might be an exception if your franchise has a nickname that's a racial epithet.
Yes,
then you're allowed to overhaul it with post haste.
It's true, but I think other teams are going to start whining about it too, and then it becomes an issue. Like, I think if you're the Miami Dolphins and you're still rolling with these, like, weird, like, modern look on a classic look when your team was actually, you know, relevant, good, I think you're thinking long and hard about that too. Change the uniforms, Dolphins.
Well, Julian Edelman, according to a tweet from him and DeSean Jackson, spoke and planned to educate each other on each of their cultures. This is the actual tweet. DeSean and I spoke for a while last night. We're making plans to use our experiences to educate one another and grow together. Stay tuned.
Good for them. I actually, honestly, I thought that that was an opportunity for personal growth. And I think that that's... regardless of your opinion of how DeSean Jackson came to post what he did, the hope is that he learns from it and doesn't ever repeat it and learns why it was wrong. And I think that having conversations between people and having someone else in the league offer to do that, I think that's a really, really positive step. I don't think we should just sort of gloss that off. And it doesn't mean that anything that happened with DeSean was okay. And I don't, because I think there are some problems and some, but the start of fixing it is not just punishing someone, but making sure that they understand why it was problematic.
Edelman deserves a lot of credit for handling his response the way that he did as a Jewish person. And I feel like that's a productive response to it. I don't think there was any malice behind what DeSean Jackson did. I think he's uninformed, and I think he did something stupid. It was very insensitive what he reposted. Much like what Drew Brees had said, to a lesser extent, was insensitive and dumb given the current state of our country as well. But people, whether it's Drew Brees or DeSean Jackson, I believe after being called out for being dumb heads, I feel like they deserve the opportunity to learn from it. And this is how we move on as a society, as opposed to continuously slinging stones and moving goalposts and talking about things that have nothing to do with the matter at hand. So good for Julian Edelman and good for DeSean Jackson for taking this step forward. We need to see more of this in life.
Well, isn't it nice to, you know, actually see instead of anger, it, you know, it's learning. It's like, you know, like, okay, let's embrace each other, and instead of just all the anger we see right now.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm okay with getting angry at people too.
I am too,
Danny.
But
I'm cool with getting mad.
But when the anger subsides, I think that taking that next step, we all need to start doing it, to sit back and to listen. It's really not that hard. It really isn't. Just try to see the other side's perspective before you get back to being angry.
That's how best friends are made.
maybe it'll be DeSean and Julian. It'll be the start of a buddy comedy that will happen going forward, appearing at next places soon. It is Danny and Gallant. The future for college sports looks very hazy. We'll tell you what we see on the horizon next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
All right, Paul. The Big Ten started it off by saying it's not official yet, but they're looking toward eliminating all non-conference competition for college athletics for their athletic teams in the fall. Most expect the ACC to follow suit, and I think at that point it's probably a matter of time before across the country. The Ivy League is not going to have fall sports competitions. We're going to see some decisions made here in the very near future. It's a bummer. I don't think anybody would say, like, oh, man, this is – it's also a reality, and I see this as the tip of what is going to be an iceberg, and I think of all the different sports that we're talking about, college sports are going to be the toughest to have played this fall. I don't think we know about how feasible it is for Major League Baseball to stay back on the field. I feel pretty good about the NBA's ability to complete its season. Not sure about football, but I think college football and college sports in general is going to be extremely tough.
It's going to be really hard for, I think, just the standpoint of all the different places and all the different regions and all the different governors and all the different, many different things that are factors public universities versus private universities as well. Not to say that there's a lot of those private universities, but I think you're right. Though I do think that the NBA might have more of a challenge given that they are trying to finish a season before starting another season, which is going to take place not too long from now. The second season, the next season. So back to the college sports, though. My biggest question is, how deep is the rabbit hole going to go? Because now, if the Big Ten has canceled out-of-conference games, every conference is going to cancel out-of-conference games. What happens next? What's the next measure that college sports realistically can take?
To delay the football seasons? And here's where it gets tricky, because football is a revenue generator for a ton of schools. Some places, the football team is actually a drain, and that can be. But in the powerhouse athletic colleges, in places which are Power Five and contending and considered to be top-tier programs, the college football team is what makes money. They make a significant amount of that money off of the gate, off of live attendance and people that are buying tickets and at the donations that come from people who buy season tickets. And in many ways, that's why from the beginning, the return of the NFL presented a different logistical challenge from the return of college football. Because if you don't have fans in the stands for college football games, I think that that impacts the economics a great deal more than it does in the NFL. I think that the NFL can say, we'll play the games and figure out how the money gets made and split up a little bit later. Whereas I think with college football, just because each school has more autonomy, even within a conference and all of the different changes, I think that it's always, I think the next step will be to try and delay it till spring. But even then, you're going to start to see dominoes fall. The first one was the 11 programs that Stanford cut. Football funds a great deal of American intercollegiate athletics. That's the way it goes. And you're going to see a massive, I suppose people will use the term reimagine, restructuring. The other thing is we're going to see a huge attrition and disintegration of college athletic departments across the country, and that's going to be really too bad.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And, I mean, shoot, we just saw it from Stanford yesterday. And, again, this is – if we have learned anything from this entire process of how people are reacting to the pandemic, it's that dominoes follow immediately afterwards. And I just wonder what the next school is going to be. I really wonder what Washington is going to do, what Washington State especially is going to do, given that they don't necessarily have the same funding as UW. So there are a lot of, I think, really, really difficult questions that are going to have to be answered. I am very glad that I am not in the position of having to answer them, especially given that the people that have to answer them are making obscene amounts of money, and that money could definitely be spent elsewhere.
How would you restructure college athletics? We've talked about this in a much different sense for years, which is how would you – I think most people realize you can't continue to justify college students not getting paid to play football given the amount of money that college football and men's basketball too and the two revenue sports that continuing to say, hey, they're amateurs, they're student athletes. We're going to now watch, though, a massive revision of athletic programs across the country. Here's the one worry I have is that as this happens, everything will become predicated about how much money you make. And the people who are going to lose in that are going to be non-revenue sports, which are going to be disproportionately women's sports. And I think of all of the different unintended consequences of opening up college sports to market pay has been the fact that we are going to see the elimination of scholarship opportunities and competitive avenues for female athletes. And colleges across the country are going to have to look at that. The part that I don't really mind is like the NCAA should disintegrate and go away. Like as we start to see these massive changes, that's the one thing. Like fire all of the people that work there. Sell the building. Sell all of the land it has. Like get rid of the – we don't – of all the different – that sort of oversight, I actually think the NCAA gets in the way of making a better system right now as opposed to helping do that. But
how do you determine a champion without them? Is that – does that matter anymore?
Yeah, build something new. Yeah, like start from scratch. like get rid of all of those people who helped manage this the entire state of college athletics to the state. Get rid of them and start from scratch. Yeah, like of all of the different things, like I think that's the easy one is, okay, we're going to build something else because it's not sustainable. Like even before COVID-19, like coronavirus is going to, it was not, there were the change, the writing was on the wall in terms of paying college athletes or letting them get marketing contracts, all of those, something was going to change. And I think that coronavirus and the shutdowns that we're going to see, both first in the spring sports, March Madness last year, and now with the potential delay in the fall, I think that you're going to see a dramatic restructuring of how sports work. I'd like to see it start out in basketball. Get the NBA to accept if a player comes onto campus, if a player enrolls in school, he's not eligible for the NBA draft for 3 years, much like in baseball. You can sign out of high school and go straight into the NBA, but once you get onto campus, a team is not allowed to draft you for 3 years. Like that would be one of the first steps to take. I'm not sure how you make sure that women's basketball and several other women's sports stay, but we can't have college athletics become entirely about men's basketball and football. Like, there have to be more sporting opportunities than that.
You would think that with the cost of tuition, that these schools would have plenty enough to go around before we're even talking about what a football program brings in to the university. Yeah, honestly, a lot of these schools, I know for me, for my sister, it was an obscene amount of money to go to Syracuse University and Harvard, respectively. So there's that side of things. Then, a question that I really do not know the answer to, Danny. Can you privatize the athletic side of things? Can you separate yourself from the school entirely? When you look at the brand of, like, Alabama football, yeah, you think about Alabama, the University of Alabama, but, I mean, you're really thinking about Alabama, the Crimson Tide. And I feel like you can sort of separate it from there. I know it's state-run, but I feel like that would be potentially the next step where certain university athletic programs, football or basketball, all of a sudden say to themselves, I mean, we can just sort of start our own thing. Are they nothing without the brand name of the university that they have and without the funding? I wonder if they actually would have a leg to stand on if they chose to do something like that.
Would you want to have minor league football? Would minor league football replace college football? For me, college football, if you had a minor league football franchise, I'm not nearly as interested in it as I am. I want my school to play football. And I want it to be the Washington Huskies, and I want them to have purple and gold uniforms, and I want them to be students that go there. I do want them to be to have a mechanism for those students to receive the benefits, the financial benefits of some of what they generate. But I don't want that to come at the expense of female sports. I think that there is an element of gender equity that needs to be. That's part of what I love about college sports. I just want to get rid of some of the bureaucrats, man.
I do too.
That comes out of it.
I want to get rid of all the bureaucrats, to be perfectly honest, because it seems like they are. Yes, it would save all of the money, in fact, and maybe some coaches need to have a look in the mirror about what their salary is and where that money could be better sent towards, especially if they're making, I don't know, whatever Jimbo Fisher's making to finish in fourth in the SEC West every single year at Texas A&M, or whatever Tom Herman's making at Texas to be just barely relevant there. But, you know, when I look at it, I would like to see that these programs still help out and help promote athletics for everyone. But I don't know that that's possible, and there is a part of me that already thinks, Danny, that these institutions have somewhat privatized themselves. You got Zion Williamson allegedly getting $400,000.
Baseball is back. The Mariners are going to play their first inter-squad game, get ready for their season. 710 ESPN Seattle is the only place to hear it. Rick Riz, Aaron Goldsmith have the action. That's today at 2:30. We also have the Professor John Clayton going to be interviewing Pete Carroll. That's coming up at 11. First, we got to raise flags. That's coming up next.
From the pocket, and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag.
flag on the play.
I don't know if it really applies to anything, but currently on the internet, Adrian Wojnarowski, who's widely recognized as the authority of breaking news in the NBA, has apparently sent a two-word response to an email that came from a senator of Missouri. The first of those two words started with the F, and the second of those two words was Y-O-U, and it was in response to the senator making a statement regarding the lack of patriotic or supportive police slogans on NBA jerseys. I'm not sure why Adrian Wojnarowski, a journalist, felt compelled to do that, but there is a certain amount of a kerfuffle that about whether or not the email is genuine, which it appears to be, and how that's possibly going to affect people's perceptions of him or of ESPN or of the coverage of the but it's funny in that I always like email chains getting made public. That's always amusing.
The email that was sent was the equivalent of junk mail / a telemarketer / spam. Respond to it how you may.
The response has the effect of making it seem as if you take umbrage with some of the criticisms that the senator made of the Chinese government, which is slightly problematic. We'll see how this one plays out. Anyway, I was just for your information and amusing, but I would just generally go, I'm not going to curse at U.S. senators. Just as a general policy, I'm going to go ahead like Democrat, Republican, whatever, you're one of the 100 in the chamber there, and I'm not going to send profane two-word responses to you. I think that's one that we can all live by.
I think I wouldn't write it out.
I want to raise a flag. I've been waiting all day to do this. Jorge Masvidal, nickname Game Bread, UFC fighter, is going to battle Kamaru Usman this weekend. And Jorge Masvidal is one of my favorite guys. I've actually seen him fight live several times. My brother, he is a super respectful and very understated guy, given how tough he is. And in his, he does not like people who talk trash. He does not like trash talking fighters. Does not like them, period, at all. And in his last fight, he fought a guy who talks a lot of trash named Ben Askren. And he knocked Ben Askren out with a thundering flying knee 5 seconds into the fight. There was one blow throw, and Ben Askren is an irreverent, sort of thinks he's smarter than he is. He's the worst, most annoying kind of trash talker. He's a dominant wrestler. So he talk. Jorge Masvidal starts out the fight leaning back on the cage with his hands behind his back, then basically ran straight at him, kneed him in his head, knocked him unconscious, then punched him twice after Askren was down on the canvas, knocked out. And when he was asked afterward about the necessity of those blows,
I saw some criticism. People say the punches weren't really necessary. Maybe
they were super necessary.
Why were they necessary?
What do you mean, why were they not necessary?
Because he was already knocked out at that point.
But the referee hadn't pulled me off. And my job is to hit somebody till the referee pulled me off. So to those people, I would say maybe don't watch him and maybe go back to soccer.
So he refuses to even say they were so super good. Necessary. He had not been stuck. But then it became clear that there was something specific, because after he hit him twice, Masvidal got down on his hands and knees and kind of pounded the canvas 3 times to indicate that he was knocked out, and later emulated what Askren looked like collapsing on his side and going to sleep. Like, it was mocking a dude who was still out unconscious next to him. And then explained why that was justified as well.
You online, so you can do anything. Everything is cool before a fight. You're allowed to do and say whatever you want. Like other fighters are not doing, talking about people's religions, wife, even kids. That's cool. But after a fight, I'm not allowed to showboat and rub it in your face. So you and guys like you could see it and be like, maybe I don't talk so much shit, because when I cross one of these real they're going to make me pay for it, man. They're going to embarrass the shit out of me. And it's not over for Ben either. He still has to deal with me. If I see him at Whole Foods, I'm going to still slap that dude up because I don't like him.
I love Jorge Masvidal. go Game Bread. I love Kamaru Usman as well, but yeah, Jorge Masvidal is my dude. Jess, would you like to raise a flag?
Yes, I would. Thank you very much. And obviously going to be raising today on this Friday as a little bit of positivity heading into the weekend. I'm raising my flag for All the college football players who are experiencing so much uncertainty right now. I know that this is a difficult time for everyone in our country and across the globe, but there is a bit that I, can relate with when it comes to not knowing your future as you've had it planned out. So I raise my flag for them. And then for all of the college athletes whose programs are getting canceled right now, it might seem a little diminutive or like ancillary to the problems that the world is facing right now. But these are all people and young people who are just thrust into a position of uncertainty when they had the most exciting time of their future planned out. So I raise my flag for you. Your future is still alive and well. And even if it goes in a different direction, I want you to know that I'm standing tall with you and you're going to be great because you got to this point so far.
Well said, Jess.
Yeah.
Lydia.
Thanks, Danny.
I'm going to raise a flag for baseball because we get live baseball on the air. And I know there'll be some haters out there that say, Lydia, hey, it's summer camp. It's spring training. It doesn't matter. It's an intra-squad game. It's going to have weird rules and not be like the baseball we know. But to hear the voice of Rick Riz and to hear Aaron Goldsmith come across our airwaves right here on 710 ESPN Seattle at 2:30 p.m. is going to be wonderful. So I say to those haters, beat it, nerds.
Beat it, nerds!
It's real to me, darn it.
Shout out, D-Gordon. Paul!
Well, first off, I'm really excited that the Seattle Sounders are back tonight. That is fantastic. 6 o'clock. Can't wait for some actual Seattle sports. It has been so, so long. I feel like the last we were watching it was Huskies basketball, which, good grief, that wasn't fun. But I want to raise a flag to the possibility of Josh Gordon returning to the NFL. This story legitimately made me sad, hearing that Gordon is auctioning the Super Bowl ring that he won in 2018 with the Patriots for $100,000. And it came after a playoff run that he didn't even play in. So he got this Super Bowl ring. He wasn't a part of the team for it. And because of, I imagine, just not being employed for as long as he's been, he's trying to find a way to turn it into something that's actually cash. It's a bummer. I really hope that he's able to turn it around. I'd like to see him get that chance here. I'd like to see him get that chance somewhere else. He seems like a person that is legitimately a good person. He just can't get out of his own way, and it's easy to get frustrated at someone like that. But you can't stop hoping for someone like that. So I hope you're able to turn it around, Josh.
I hope so, too. It's going to do it for us today. Remember, we got the Professor John Clayton talking to Pete Carroll at 11 a.m., 2:30 this afternoon. Intra-squad baseball, Rick Riz, Aaron Goldsmith right here. Thanks to Michael Bumpus, the Professor John Clayton, Jessamyn McIntyre, Lydia Cruz. They are the bright side of this program, and he is Paul Gallant. And, yeah, if it ever comes up in an email from a senator, do not send back a two-word response.
Yes, I won't ever send it back, but I will think things. And he is Danny O'Neill, and don't you ever question the dominance of the early 2010 Seattle Seahawks defense. So long, farewell, have a great weekend, and you'll hear from us on Monday.